Welcome to the second installment of Giving Psychology Away. This week, procrastination and the Internet's best personality test. But first, authorized crib cards do not improve exam performance. This was in the journal Teaching Psychology, Volume 32, 2005, by Dixon and Miller. Have you ever had a teacher allow you to make a cheat sheet or a crib card for an exam? Do they affect your grade or not? And if you are allowed, does it help you to be less anxious before or during the test? Well, Dixon and Miller were curious about these things, and they asked 54 college students to develop crib cards for a human development class on a 5x8-inch card, only allowed to use one side. Students were randomly assigned to making cards for exams 1 and 3, or 2 and 4, and another group of students was allowed to use crib cards only on the tests 2 and 4. At the end of each exam, students reported whether they used a crib card and whether they felt it was helpful, and if they thought it increased, decreased, or had no effect on their anxiety level. Well, 79% of students said that they thought using a crib card would decrease their anxiety when asked before the test, but only 40% said that it actually worked. And also, students did no better on exams when they used the crib cards than when they didn't. So that's why they counterbalanced exams 1 and 3 with exams 2 and 4 to make sure that one of those tests wasn't harder, and therefore there was a difference that was attributable to the difficulty of the exam rather than the use or not of crib cards. Additionally, students reported a very similar amount of time spent studying whether they used the crib cards or whether they didn't. So apparently students just reallocate some of the time that they would have used to study to creating one of these crib cards. So I guess so much for cheat sheets. There's also a really good study called Discredited Psychological Treatments and Tests, a Delphi poll. This was by Norcross, Kucher, and Garofalo in the journal Professional Psychology Research and Practice, Volume 37, 2006. Now, a Delphi poll is a way to get experts to agree and come to a consensus on some issue. In this case, which psychological tests and treatments are pseudoscientific or unvalidated? So basically, they're looking for quackery, and they're asking these experts to identify what tests and procedures are junk. The participants for this poll were fellows of different divisions of the American Psychological Association, namely Division 12, which is clinical psychology, Division 17, which is counseling psychology, and Division 16, which is school psychology, as well as fellows of the American Psychological Society, the APS. They also asked editors of scholarly journals and so forth. These are preeminent people in the field. The authors of the study, Norcross and his colleagues, made a list of every questionable treatment they could find or test in the last 100 years that people use or have used in the United States. These notable people rated the treatments and tests on a scale from 1 to 5, from not at all discredited, number 1, to certainly discredited, number 5. After the first round of scoring, the authors sent the results back to the experts to rate them again. This usually results in more agreement the second time around. So these are colleagues looking at how other colleagues have said these tests rate in their opinion. Respondents were also able to say, I'm not familiar enough with this this test or procedure. So they weren't just marking certainly discredited on anything that they didn't know about. So when we average all these results out, a 4.5 and up was considered certainly discredited. So it's on a scale of 1 to 5, enough people were saying that's a 5 that the authors considered that to be certainly discredited. The list of those are angel therapy, use of pyramid structures, orgone therapy, I'm not sure what that is, O-R-G-O-N-E, probably not pronouncing that correctly, crystal healing, past lives therapy, future lives therapy, treatments for PTSD caused by alien abduction, rebirthing therapies, color therapy, primal scream, and chiropractic manipulation, as well as thought field therapy, and standard prefrontal lobotomy, and aromatherapy. Now remember that this means that experts considered these things discredited for treating mental and behavioral disorders. It doesn't mean, for example, that they reject chiropractic manipulation outright, just for the treatment of mental and behavioral disorders. Just as an example of scale here, neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, which you hear a lot about, received a 3.96, so right around probably discredited overall. And DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education, received a 3.79 after the second round. So both of these are considered to be probably discredited treatment for what their intended effect. Similarly, five tests were rated as certainly discredited, including the Luscher color test, the Sondi test, handwriting analysis, graphology, which a lot of people have heard of, Bender visual motor gestalt test for the assessment of neuropsychological impairment, so not the Bender gestalt for other things, anagrams, which again I think I'm probably mispronouncing, E-N-E-A-G-R-A-M-S, and Lowenfield mosaic test. Now, there was a gender difference on several of these tests. Women were harder on, or they thought they were more discredited, aromatherapy, family therapy based on the double bind theory of schizophrenia, future lives therapy, primal scream therapy, and sexual reorientation or reparative therapy for homosexuality, while men were harder on Jungian sand therapy, the house tree person technique, the Kahn test of symbol arrangement, and the Luscher color test. Now, most interesting to me was that how an expert self-identified in terms of their theoretical orientation mattered a great deal in how they ranked things. Those who identified as cognitive or behavioral psychologists were much more skeptical of these various treatments and interventions. Psychodynamic and humanistic psychologists were the least skeptical, and eclectic or integrative therapists or psychologists were in the middle. So, for example, the average rating of these of the cognitive and behavioral therapists or psychologists was about a 4.4, which is between probably and certainly discredited, whereas the psychodynamic and humanistic, on average, across all of these tests, was a 2.8, between unlikely discredited and possibly discredited. And for eclectics and integrativists, about a 3.4, so that's between possibly and probably discredited. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up on Giving Psychology Away is that as a consumer of any sort of psychological treatment, it's important that you know that there is a growing consensus about things which are discredited or which are highly suspect in the opinion of people in the field. It's important to ask a therapist what sort of practice they have. Do they consider themselves cognitive behavioral, psychodynamic, eclectic? And to look up these terms and see what they mean by that. It's always important to be an informed consumer of psychological treatments. Let's talk about a test that didn't make the list of discredited treatments and tests, and that is the idea of the five-factor model of personality. People have been trying to discover what is fundamental to human personality for a very long time. In fact, a lot of people are familiar with the Myers-Briggs type of a personality assessment, and that's based on the idea that there are four bipolar, meaning there's two poles, personality factors. Those are extrovert and introvert, the sensing intuitive, thinking versus feeling, judging versus perceiving. There's been a lot of research on a number of different personality dimensions, and one of the things that kept happening in research is that five factors were kind of emerged from the much greater number of factors that were investigated. So, for example, people who thought maybe gregariousness and excitement-seeking were two different human personality factors found that they kind of went together. They covaried very well together. So when factor analysis was applied over and over again to these various personality tests, five factors keep hopping out. And those are that tend to be called the five-factor model of personality. These five factors are extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, emotional stability, and intellect, or openness to experience. Now, if you want to learn about the five-factor model of personality and test yourself with a full 300-item battery that gives all five factors and facets, go to personalitytest.net, and on the left side of the screen, you'll see a link to the IPIP-NEO, N-E-O. And there are two versions, a 300-item version, and a 120-item version. The 300-item version gives you all of the facets. There are six facets to each factor, so it's much more in-depth. Of course, it takes longer. It takes almost an hour in some cases to take. That's why I like to think of it as the mother of all internet personality tests. Let's talk a little bit about the factors and then their facets. Extroversion is... has six facets, which kind of describe different elements of that overall factor. For example, friendliness and gregariousness are not the same thing. It is possible to be friendly, but not gregarious, but those things tend to go together in a real solid factor called extroversion. So the six facets of extroversion are friendliness, gregariousness, assertiveness, activity level, excitement seeking, and general cheerfulness. So you can see how it is possible for someone to be maybe high on one and low on the other one, but they're not going to be extremely different in most cases. And it turns out when you do this mathematically, when you look at it statistically, this factor of extroversion holds together real well. Another factor is called agreeableness, and that has to do with being straightforward or modest, being trusting, being cooperative, having sympathy for others, being altruistic. Now, this sounds like a good thing, but research has shown that it is possible to be too agreeable and to not take care of oneself and be manipulated, actually, at very high levels of agreeableness. One thing I should mention with this whole test, if you go ahead and take it, is that even if you score in the extreme range on any of these, it does not imply that you have some sort of psychological disorder. These are the five factors of normal human personality, and people vary on them significantly. Another factor is known as conscientiousness, and that is made up of orderliness, dutifulness, achievement strivings, self-discipline, and cautiousness. All of these things make up this general factor of conscientiousness. Factor number four is called emotional stability, and that has to do with experiencing anxiety, anger, depression, self-consciousness, immoderation, or kind of impulsive behavior, and then vulnerability. Again, even if you're very high on this, does not mean that you have a psychological disorder. And the last, the intellect or openness to experience dimension, has to do with being imaginative, artistic, experiencing emotion very acutely, adventurousness, intellect, and liberalism. The five-factor model of personality is being extensively investigated in the literature. In fact, there are some people who are claiming that animals have these same five personality factors as kind of a fundamental level of personality in them as well. There are studies that link these five factors of personality with musical preferences. You know, what kind of music does someone who is high on openness to experience like? The reason why I bring up the five-factor model of personality and point out this test to you is that I want to talk to you about procrastination, but it sort of doesn't make much sense without talking first about this five-factor model of personality. Now, this article on procrastination that I found is by Piers Steele from the University of Calgary, and it's entitled The Nature of Procrastination, A Meta-Analytic and Theoretical Review of Quintessential Self-Regulatory Failure. And it's found in the Psychological Bulletin, 2007, Volume 133. Now, what Dr. Steele has done here is called a meta-analysis, and that is when you take a number of studies that have been done on a single topic and you distill them into some common findings throughout. Now, procrastination has been studied by a lot of people, and there's been a lot of theories about what it actually is. And the most important thing that Dr. Steele brings up is that it is an irrational delay of behavior. So even when you know that delaying action will result in you being worse off, you still do it. That's procrastination. The author reviews the literature and points out that one researcher found a correlation of 0.77 over 10 years on a measure of procrastination. That is, procrastination seems to be a pretty stable trait. He also brings up that the big five factor of conscientiousness is very likely a big component of procrastination. So let's talk about interventions. Dr. Steele points out that one way of decreasing procrastination for a given task is to increase one's expectancy of success. So if you can succeed on smaller versions of a larger project and build up your sense that you can do this, or observe others who are similar to yourself who successfully complete the task, you're less likely to procrastinate on it. Also, if you increase your skills so that you feel like you have more ability to do that task, then you're less likely to procrastinate as well. Now, people procrastinate more on tasks that seem boring to them. So actually, sometimes increasing the difficulty of a task can help you reduce boredom and also reduce procrastination. So if you make it a little bit harder or challenging for yourself, then if you have a high need for achievement, then you might be less likely to procrastinate on that task. however, be warned that if you make it too hard for yourself and you cause yourself to fail, then you're actually more likely to procrastinate in the future. So you're setting yourself up to experience failure and then more procrastination. Since people who procrastinate tend to be very distractible and impulsive, it's important to surround yourself with cues that remind you of success rather than temptations to be to do something else. So if you're going to take breaks, take them outside of your office so that in your office you feel like this is the place where I get work done rather than trying to play some Tetris and then go back to work and then play some more Tetris and waste time in your cubicle or in your office. As technology increases, our ability to procrastinate becomes greater and greater. Desktop alerting software that tells you when you have new email or when you have a new MySpace comment can lead to procrastination because impulsively one sees that and decides, oh, you need to go check and see what that is. Another factor to decrease procrastination is making proximal goals. So in other words, goals on the way to a larger goal, which should increase motivation because it's a more obtainable goal, it's closer in time. So for a number of reasons, if you have a shorter goal, a goal that's achievable today, you are able to do more things and procrastinate less. Also, goals tend to be more effective when they're set by someone else. So if you can get even a good friend to give you some goals, set some goals for you, then you're likely to reduce your amount of time that you're going to procrastinate. And that's all for today. Please direct your questions and comments to givingpsychologyaway@gmail.com.